From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As we hurtle toward the midterm elections this November, many Americans who despair of the future of our nation under Donald Trump's presidency are hoping Democrats will win majorities in both houses of Congress and save the day. But Trump and his party have already done so much damage, rolling back rights and regulations. As Trump ushers in an era of white minority rule over an increasingly diverse nation, it is easy to give in to the despair and hope we survive the next couple of years, putting our faith simply in politicians. But a new book urges Americans, at least those of us who reject the notion of alternative facts, that we have far more power than we think we do. Anesha Roy Chowdhury is a writer, editor, and educator. Her work has been published in Rolling Stone, Boston Review, The Nation, American Prospect, Salon, and Mother Jones. She's the co-founder of Speech Act, an organization working at the intersection of storytelling and social justice. And she joins me to discuss her new book called The Marginalized Majority, Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. Welcome to the program, Anesha.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you open your book sharing a personal anecdote about how you have grown up realizing that you, as a brown woman, are considered an other by a member of your own family. Share that story with us.
Sure. Yeah. So my father is Indian. He came over from India kind of recently in his 20s. And then my mother is white American, and her family has been here for a few generations. And I have sort of an ex-uncle now because my aunt divorced him. But growing up, this uncle by marriage, he did not believe in what he called mixed marriage. And so what this actually looked like is that he just refused to speak to me or look at me. And this created a very awkward situation, obviously, made for some awkward dinner table conversations or lack thereof. But I tell this story because I think it is actually not so atypical in American culture. And I think it's emblematic of the fact that racism and misogyny, these kinds of things are really baked into the infrastructure of this country. And it's oftentimes those of us who are marginalized who bear the brunt of just sort of having to normalize or react as though we are the problem in a way. So, you know, growing up, I never said anything to that uncle. It was never really discussed. And it wasn't until I was, you know, a grown adult that I really started to reckon with how just messed up this was. But I also feel fortunate that I had that experience because, again, I feel like it offers a pretty clear insight and example of how these forces are just constantly at work.
Right. We have been lulled into, before Trump especially, lulled into a sense of false security that the era of overt racism, racial resentment by whites against people of color is over. That was a thing of the past, the stuff of history books. And then, of course, the shock of Trump's rise brought that all back. And now we see that those racist forces never went away. They were simply lying low. They've come out into the open. They've been emboldened. And that is the most sort of shocking manifestation of what I referred to as white minority rule earlier in my introduction, this idea that a majority minority country, meaning a country that will very soon be majority people of color in states like California, already whites are a minority, or they're not a plurality, I should say, that this is a nation that is being set up to have largely white rule, but it doesn't have to be this way. How did you, through this past year and a half under Trump's rule, which has turned out to be worse than any of us could have imagined, how did you fight cynicism?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big part of why I was moved to write this book is that immediately after the election, I feel like we were just sort of inundated with a lot of narratives in headlines and a lot of news stories, all about how we've never been more divided as a country. And obviously there has been, as you mentioned, this resurgence of really blatant racism, but, you know, obviously this kind of racism is you know, institutional, it runs deep. And the fact is that we right now are not more divided than ever. There's a small contingent of extremists, that much is true, but I think it's being blown out of proportion because the media is perpetuating this story that we've never been more divided. And what I came to discover after doing a lot of research and a lot of writing and a lot of interviewing is that there is a divide that's occurring right now, but the divide is not between the majority of Americans, the divide is not between Americans. It's the larger divide at play right now that is more important is the divide between what the majority of Americans want and what a handful of extremists in power are offering. And so I think into this chasm of power, we're starting to see some really encouraging things, which is we see people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez winning. We see Stacey Abrams in Georgia winning. We just saw Andrew Gillum in Florida. And what's interesting to me is that these are people who are campaigning unapologetically about who they are, how their identity impacted their experience of America, and how they're going to address really straightforward issues that the majority of Americans are concerned about, whether it's access to healthcare, education, really basic things that the majority of Americans can get behind. And yet what we still see, which is so frustrating, is this ongoing reaction in the media that, oh my God, what an upset that these people are winning. It's totally unexpected. And in reality, I think it's the least surprising thing in the world. We're just seeing people who are finally speaking to the needs and desires of the majority of Americans.
Hmm. Well, you brought up Andrew Gillum in Florida. He is the first Black nominee for governor of a major party in Florida's history. The day after he won that primary race, his opponent, Ron DeSantis, went on the media and said things like he was an articulate spokesperson, which is a sort of a backhanded racist compliment, and then actually went as far as saying the last thing we need to do is to monkey this up by trying to embrace a socialist agenda with huge tax increases and bankrupting the state. For a white man to say monkey this up about a Black man is such a straightforward racist term that it seems as though Trump and his fellow Americans, because it's not just Trump, are using racism as their major and only campaign platform. They offer scapegoating people of color, white minority rule, white supremacy versus everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's disturbing to see, but at the same time, it seems like such a last gasp effort in a lot of ways. The reality is, as you mentioned, that the direction this country is going in is that we are increasingly a majority of brown people, immigrants. And, you know, I feel like what we're seeing is this sort of last gasp of people grasping at this power, at holding on to, of this minority trying to hold on to power. And in reality, when you look at the breakdown of Americans, it's roughly 31 to 32% of Americans are white male. So when you look at the constitution of who makes up America here, we're talking about brown people, immigrants, queer people. And then if you also include white progressive allies, we already are the majority. So, you know, while I find this racist dog whistling extremely problematic and disturbing, I also feel like to be preoccupied with the notion that these people are going to have the power and have the power and will inevitably continue to have the power is just simply not true. What we need to do is continue to support candidates, run for office also, who are speaking to the majority of Americans, who are getting out the vote. You know, I think one of the best interviews I saw of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez after her victory was on the late night Colbert show. And he addressed, you know, he was like, well, how did you do it? You know, like the numbers, the breakdown, it had you so far behind. How did you do it? And she very matter-of-factly said, well, you know, when people talk about getting out the vote, generally when polls are run, what happens is they're polling more the likely voters, right? And she was like, well, what we did is we just got out the vote among people who don't typically come out and vote. And I think that that is something that I hope more Americans pay attention to. When we look at these polls that are perpetuated through headlines and, you know, circulated on Facebook and everywhere else, as though they're a marker of what's definitely going to happen. I mean, I think we saw in the presidential election that clearly polls are failing us. And the reason is that there is a large contingent of Americans who are not coming out to vote that we need to reach out to. And I feel like that's where a lot of our focus needs to be.
Now, one of the presidential candidates who did generate incredible excitement among those people who don't ordinarily vote is, of course, Barack Obama. And you also write in your book, The Marginalized Majority, how you let Obama's election serve as a bomb. And this is a really important part of the discussion, of course, because there's a reason why Trump was able to win the Electoral College, scraping through a win when he should have basically been at the very bottom of the barrel. He shouldn't have even won the Republican nomination, and then he shouldn't have won the Electoral College. But Democrats and the establishment Democrats bear a big part of the blame, don't they? Because they have simply been complacent and not really prioritized the interests of a majority of Americans who are struggling, whether those Americans are white or non-white.
Absolutely. And I think what we're seeing now is that Americans, the majority of Americans, what they want is just categorically far to the left of what establishment Democrats and Republicans, and I'm saying Democrats because that's important. You know, we're talking about how they are failing repeatedly to address what the majority of Americans want, and so they need to recognize that that in order to win, which there's never been a larger opportunity than now to really cultivate voters, to really speak honestly and frankly to the gross disparities in equality and privilege and status in this country, and literally to just speak straightforward truth. We're seeing time and again in different elections that is what is winning. So I really hope that they take the hint. And even if they don't, the fact is the voters will force them to.
Anisha, your book subtitle is Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. I wanted to address that issue of the post-truth America because Trump, if there's one thing he's skillful at, it's manipulating media coverage, manipulating the narrative, setting the agenda so that only what he wants to be discussed will be discussed. His claims of fake news, even as he has become the president who has spewed more lies than any other president in history, unfortunately, are quite effective. So all of these issues coming up that Americans can have clarity over in terms of a common agenda, etc., can still very easily fall prey to the scourge of really fake news, right? And that's a big battle, the battle over what reality itself is, which is, it sounds new, but of course it's an old battle because authoritarian regimes have always used propaganda to make their case.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you characterized that, you used language that was really important, which is like letting them set the agenda, right? And I think this is tricky terrain. I spend a lot of time thinking about it, but the fact is, progressives and folks on the left, we're very good at, you know, we're always following the news, we're always reading, and we have a tendency to fall easily into defensiveness just mainly defensiveness. And I think that the problem comes when we are just sort of following the latest absurd thing that Trump is saying on Twitter, right? We're letting that dictate the parameters of what we're talking about. And so the tricky line, I think, is that obviously we need to be paying attention to what Trump is doing in as much as it has real repercussions and effects on Americans every single day. But to be mindful of the fact that this is someone who comes from reality TV. This is someone who feeds off, you know, their ego being stroked. They want attention. He wants attention. And so I think it's important to not be so distracted by whatever sensational thing he said that we surrender the terms of the argument. We surrender the terms of what we're really talking about. And I feel like if we do that, we lose. So we just need to be mindful of not letting this handful of extremists who are in power totally co-opt the conversation.
Now, we mentioned some of the successes that progressives have had at the primary elections over the past several months, which has been very, very heartening. And of course, the presidential candidacy of Bernie Sanders, certainly, and winning, you know, coming so close to winning the Democratic nomination is definitely a cause for celebration. But those are all successes in the electoral realms and efforts that are electoral. What about outside pressures? Because, of course, it's critical for there to be grassroots pressure from below, even as people work through the electoral system and the democratic system. You write in your book about Occupy Wall Street, which seems to be this forgotten moment, but didn't happen so long ago, happened under a liberal democratic presidency, and raised issues in such an effective way and caught on like wildfire that for a moment we were all extremely excited about some sort of revolution. So what is the legacy of Occupy Wall Street, and why should we count that as a major success?
Yeah, and one of the things I discuss at length in the book is how the media and how we as everyday Americans, as a result, tend to think about protest and the impact of protest or lack thereof. And something that's interesting is that when we look throughout history at, say, like the civil rights movement, you know, categorically, Americans tend to think of that as a necessary movement. Something that we are all proud of, except of course for a handful of extremists. But in reality, at the time, freedom riders, other protesters, they were not supported by the majority of Americans. We have a long legacy in this country of tending to think of protest as a waste of time, until those movements are successful, until later on in history books, we say, of course that needed to happen. Of course that's inevitable. And we see that happening today, whether it's Occupy Wall Street or Black Lives Matter or the Women's March. There tend to be just this bevy of headlines talking about the pointlessness of these movements. And the reality is that on the ground, something like Occupy Wall Street was hugely instrumental in changing the conversation. It impacted elections like the mayoral race in New York City. It impacted the presidential debates between Mitt Romney and Obama. It shaped conversations. And also on the ground, it had really fundamental and practical repercussions. So for instance, locally, Occupy Wall Street, you know, in the wake of Hurricane Sandy, when federal aid was extremely slow to show up, it was the Occupy Wall Street organizing network that arranged for buses and people. They coordinated people going to the areas of, you know, houses and the people who were hardest hit and providing aid and support. And there is a direct line between the kind of organizing infrastructure that was laid during Occupy Wall Street and then subsequent movements like Black Lives Matter, like the Fight for 15, And again, we see today, like the Women's March, while there were so many headlines that were talking about, like, well, sure, it's a big protest, but, you know, what are they actually doing? They don't have a clear demand. You know, the fact is, there are many women who attended that march who then ran for office and unseated GOP men. The problem is that the way that the media tends to cover protest, we're not very good at connecting the dots, right? So it's not necessarily the most direct, oh, well, Women's March happened this day, and then 2 days later, Trump left office. That's not how it works. But that doesn't mean that protest isn't hugely effective and important.
There's also the very critically important issue of winning the culture war, if you will. And this goes back to our conversation around how racial resentment gets effectively whipped up. How we talk about these issues is so critical. The language we use, the framing we use. You point out in your book that we have come to a point in the United States, which may be an indication of kind of how low things have gone, where we trust comedians more than we trust journalists. How important. And of course, this is also an age-old phenomenon, the court jester who can tell the truth while others can't because they use comedy as a tool. How important are comedians to this moment? Comedians were very powerful during the George W. Bush era. He was perfect fodder for comedy. It feels as though Trump is so depressing that even comedians are having a hard time effectively making fun of him, or maybe not. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I think comedy, political comedy, has become extremely important. And in part, it points to some media failures. And I think that there are a lot of newsrooms right now that are really trying to take stock of how to be responsible when you're covering someone who is so abusive of power, like Trump. And one of the major problems there is that while we talk about objectivity as being this sort of paragon of journalism, it's often not clearly defined. It's not defined. And so what happens is you just have this more subtle policing of tone and content. So then an editor might say, well, I don't know, maybe take that out. It might seem too extreme. And so I think this kind of cautious, overhandled, without being clear about what the guidelines are, that has resulted in a lot of subpar coverage. And so into that kind of chasm, what you have is political comedy. You have these truth tellers, right, who are willing to speak to the grotesquery in politics in a way that's very straightforward. And one of the things I try to unpack in the book is that I feel like there are different kinds of comedy. And I find that some actually promotes a kind of cynicism, you know, the sense that, well, if people in power are behaving poorly or abusing their power, what else can we expect? That's just the norm. And I think when we saw, Tina Fey doing Sarah Palin, what was kind of mind-blowing about that is so often she was basically just repeating Sarah Palin's actual quotes almost verbatim. And then when Sarah Palin actually became a guest on the show, it created this sense of, well, what is the role of satire? If you're doing nothing except repeating those in power, then what are you actually doing? And I think we've started to see an evolution in how political comedians are dealing with this. So we have the second generation of political comedy shows like the Sam B Show, like the John Oliver Show, where I think that there's often a tendency towards a much more truth-telling oriented comedy that is encouraging Americans to take action often and in their comedy holding those in power account, right? That there's this bar, and the joke is often about how far from that bar those people in power are behaving, which creates like this reinforcement. It's pointing out where we should be, rather than sort of laughing it off and saying, well, what more can we expect? Let's kind of put our heads in the sand, which we saw again with Tina Fey and the sheet cake monologue that was brilliant in a lot of ways, but the end note was really, really sad, which was essentially we should just stick our heads in the sand and wait it out, which she actually in later interviews said she regretted and wishes she could have done differently.
I actually want to quote a section from your book because I just think it's so so important, and I haven't really seen it being articulated like this in a chapter of your book, The Marginalized Majority. You write, "Before Trump, Americans were well versed in the corrupt politician, but we were still used to a certain kind of propriety, even if it was only lip service. Presidential candidates weren't meant to brag publicly about how they gamed the system because it spoke of their utter lack of regard for it, their cynicism for it. It was everyday Americans, entertainers, and satirists who held that privilege. We relied on the commander-in-chief to retain some semblance of earnestness so that we could maintain some faith in the system we relied on to pave our roads, keep our water clean, educate us, and help us remain healthy. But Trump has engaged in a special kind of truth-telling. He's not a truth-teller in the vein of Diogenes because he has no interest in using his truth to hold those in power accountable. He's a truth-teller in that he boasts openly about using and abusing power to advance advance himself and consolidate his own power at every turn. He's simply the ultimate logical, cynical conclusion to the trajectory we've been traveling. And he's reflecting back to us our worst behaviors and our utter contempt for politics. I feel like this part of your book is really important because if we put it into context, what he is doing seems to reflect, and the reason why he has this unwavering support among a certain bloc of Americans is because he's reflecting exactly the kind of behavior that this particular small minority of Americans embodies or aspires to, and they just love seeing somebody like the person they want to be in power blowing it all up. But they are a minority, right? We have to keep reminding ourselves that they are a minority.
Yeah, they're a minority. And also, you know, I think all of us, even, you know, even and especially on the left, we all have this tendency towards cynicism, right? It's very easy to throw up our hands and say, things are so bad, you know, and try to sort of laugh it off and say, like, you know, and I'm not saying that we should not be looking for places to find humor. I think humor, when practiced with a robust integrity, is incredibly powerful. But I really dug into this in the book because I think it's important that we don't fall into this trap of perpetuating the cynicism that is exactly what led to the rise of someone like Trump. Because at the end of the day, the fact is Trump is a symptom of a larger problem. And I, you know, greatly look forward to the day, which I hope is very soon, that Trump is gone, but our work will not be done then. And I just really hope that we all hold on to that, that this is something that goes far beyond Trump. And I'm really encouraged because I feel like the change that we're seeing, the mobilization, both in terms of who's running for office, and the numbers of people who are protesting, who are in the streets, who are calling their congressmen and women, this is truly democracy in action. And this is the beginning of a long journey that I hope will lead to a place that we will be truly proud of.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, Anesha. Good luck with your book.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Anesha Roy Chowdhury, writer, editor, and educator. Her work has been published in Rolling Stone, Boston Review, The Nation, American Prospect Salon, and Mother Jones. We've been discussing her new book, The Marginalized Majority Claiming Our Power in a Post-Truth America. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram at RUWithSonali.